This week, we welcome Ryan Benson, Director of Service Offerings at DeepWatch, to discuss the state of the managed detection and response market. In the leadership and communications section, six types of CISO and the companies they thrive in, what are the habits of highly effective CISOs? Cybersecurity is not a four-letter word, and more. Business Security Weekly starts now.
This is Security Weekly, for security professionals by security professionals. Broadcasting live from G-Unit Studios in Rhode Island, it's the show where we explore the business of security to improve the security of business. Your trusted source for actionable insights on leadership, communication, and innovation. Get ready for Business Security Week. With over half of enterprise security budgets going towards detection and response in 2020, the challenge is investing in solutions that can migrate and scale with your business. ExtraHop helps security teams spot threats up to 95% faster and respond 60% more efficiently in hybrid and multi-cloud environments with cloud-native network detection and response. Kick the tires in the full product demo at securityweekly.com/ExtraHop. The question is simple. Have any of the systems on my network been compromised? The answer is harder than it should be. Enter AI Hunter. Active Countermeasures has automated and streamlined techniques used by the best pen testers and threat hunters in the industry to create AI Hunter, a network threat hunting solution that does the first pass of a hunt for you to identify systems that are most likely to be compromised and scores the results on a scale from 0 to 100. You can then research those systems in depth with AI Hunter. Focus your valuable time on the systems that need your expertise with AI Hunter. Sign up for a personal demo today at securityweekly.com/ACM.
Welcome to Business Security Weekly. This is episode number 189, recorded September 28th, 2020. I am your host, Matt Alderman, here in Colorado. Joining me from G-Unit Studios in Rhode Island are my co-hosts, Mr. Paul Asadorian and Mr. Jason Albuquerque.
Hey, Matt. Good to be here.
It's a wonderful Monday.
It is. We're not going to talk football because for most teams, it was not a good weekend.
Yeah. I was just Broncos talking lost. About this wonderful cigar that Paul shared.
Oh, yeah.
Nothing about football. Come on now.
Opus X Oscuro.
Mm-hmm.
Yum.
Yeah. Now I got to get back into studio.
Jason's like, we need a special occasion. I'm like, it's Monday. It's BSW.
The Patriots won.
Yeah. Like,
Denver lost.
Go for it.
When you're dead, someone else is going to smoke them. So.
Would you like to have all of your favorite Security Weekly content at your fingertips? Have a question for one of our illustrious hosts, someone from the Security Weekly team, or wish you could hang out with the Security Weekly crew and the community? Subscribe on your favorite podcast catcher, sign up for the mailing list, or join our Discord server to stay in the loop on all things Security Weekly. Visit securityweekly.com/subscribe. Also, its official Security Weekly, in partnership with Cyber Risk Alliance, is excited to present Security Weekly Unlocked on December 10th, 2020. The inaugural edition of Security Weekly Unlocked also celebrates Security Weekly's 15th anniversary. Registration and call for speakers are now open. I opened up registration this morning. Visit securityweekly.com/unlock to register for the event or to submit your speaking session. This segment is sponsored by DeepWatch. To learn more, please visit securityweekly.com/DeepWatch. Ryan Benson is here. He is DeepWatch's Director of Service Offerings. He's also responsible for building go-to-market strategy and operational effectiveness across DeepWatch's managed detection and response, managed EDR, managed firewall, and vulnerability management services. Ryan has over 15 years of experience in managed security services in roles such as Cyber Operations Officer, Director of Managed Security Services, and Senior Director of Risk Compliance and Security Operations. Ryan also served as Gartner Analyst covering security operation technologies, including SIEM, Cyber Threat Intelligence, and Managed Security Services. Ryan, welcome to Business Security Weekly.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me here today.
Yeah, you know, we want to get into this conversation about managed detection and response, but before we get there, let's kind of back up a little bit. You covered the managed security services space, and there's a history of managed security services. There's also some stigma with managed security services. So I want to backtrack a little bit and talk about MSSPs, the evolution of MSSPs, and then why MDR, and what's the difference between an MSSP and a managed detection response company?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, what we've seen over the years is everyone's needed security operations. So as we've built networks and decided we need to monitor what's going on, new technologies have spun up from that. And, you know, companies didn't have enough people to build their own in-house, you know, security operations center or SOC. So the MSSP market really rolled out from that and what services they could deliver on the different technologies that people had. So, you know, a long time ago, most commonly it was a firewall or just managing route switch for a customer. And firewall technologies had different feature sets that were built into that. So we, you can, you know, take a commodity service where I can, you know, take a change request, make a change for a customer, and then pass it back over to them. They continue their daily business. The MSSP market's really spun out from the newer technologies like, you know, like SIEM, like incident monitoring. EDR is one of the technologies that's been really hot in the market for people who are using network detection and response. So MSSP really came about because there just hasn't been enough people available in the security market to do these jobs and not enough money in each company to you know, foundationally run them. From MSSP, MDR spun out from the necessity that we've kind of realized now that, well, if I'm monitoring your network, I'm seeing the logs, I have the intelligence, you know, something happened. Why aren't you doing something about it, right? If I haven't put in a preventative measure in place and I'm being attacked and I'm paying for a SOC as a service or, you know, MSSP, like, why haven't you stopped that from occurring? Or can you stop it right now? So detection and response piece of it's really spun out from the both capability to now be able to respond to those things using like an EDR tool where you can, you know, send a command to an agent and be able to isolate communication to a device or, you know, kill a computer or kill a process. And now people are kind of, or companies are really kind of expecting that as part of the service and part of the outcomes they're paying for to outsource to a provider.
Yeah, because I remember the early days of MSSPs really going after the firewall, the IDS, and managing those devices, right? It was more of a monitoring kind of service than it was, you know, it was some maintenance and some monitoring, but that was pretty much it. And we saw the MSSPs evolve and start to add some additional capabilities, right? They started to add some vulnerability management. Then they created some agent technologies or licensed an agent technology and started to do some aspects of EDR. But really, they were still kind of monitoring. They weren't really taking kind of action or control, right, in the environment. And is that the big difference now with an MDR versus an MSSP? Because I'm assuming an MSSP can be an MDR, but an MDR is more than an MSSP?
Yeah, see, I would definitely think of MDR as a subset of MSSP. And it has some additional capabilities, like when you have your own technology stack. Like if I can take in feeds from anything and be able to correlate what's happening and then do something about it, that may be something that company's built themselves. But, you know, traditionally MSSP covers a lot more things than what the MDR would. MDR really is just a spin out from that. And so there's been more investment and more companies popping up that are just doing MDR. But if you're just doing that thing, you're not covering the other components of what are necessary to run a security operations center. Like you mentioned, like vulnerability management, like managing the firewall. I mean, those things still exist today and they're still just as important as they were in the past. Now we're just having the capability to add in a layer of response to those things. So when I think about it, I think about it in a sense of response as a big R, little R, right? Either you're the little R being like, I could, you know, do an investigation and say like, well, I think this happened, so you should probably do this to fix it. Mm-hmm. Whereas big R would be, I saw something happen and I went ahead and stopped it from happening and then go back and do the investigation and see where else that was occurring. So I think what we're seeing is more companies are trying to get to the big R, but most MDRs are still at that little R. We just kind of see what's there and tell you what happens as that's our response to the event. We haven't moved to the, you know, really being able to do that holistically for companies.
And I think that's the benefit, right? I mean, most organizations are looking for that full scope service. They want to have a service provider that can offer end-to-end support, right? They don't want just event monitoring. They don't want just move ad changes. They want that full scope service. And why not, you know, our customers say this all the time, why not have one neck to choke, right? We want to make, exactly. You know, and yeah. We want to make sure that we have in the more positive way to put that is we want one business partner.
Right.
We want a single business partner who's responsible for these set of activities. And it should be from an operations center perspective, as full scope as it can possibly be, because they're under the constraints of not being able to find the talent. Mm-hmm. Right. And it's across the board. It's not just from the event management side. It's from all aspects of it. Right. So they're challenged. So let's have one vendor come in and do it all for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think another thing too that, that builds into that is that since we've had so many companies that had multi-vendor strategies and using different product sets, you kind of have two different MDRs that have come out on the market. One is, you know, technology agnostic, just whatever you're using, feed it to me and I'll take from that. Or I have a platform myself, use my stuff, deploy my agents, and I'll take care of stuff for you. So there's really different use cases when it comes to it as well. So companies really have to understand that when they buy into it, because, you know, if you buy a company that gives you their stuff to use and run, and let's say don't provide a good service, well, now you're going back to stage one again, because you're like, well, I want a new provider. You got to rip everything out and put every new stuff back in. So, you know, one of the things that DeepWatch did when spinning this out was, look, we're going to pick kind of best in breed products customers are using today, like Splunk on the SIM side, and it's their license. We'll co-manage it. We'll make sure we're getting all the events from it. We take care of it for them, but it's still there. So if they decide they don't like us, there you go. Hand it right back, same data, everything else is there. And we've already built in use cases and stuff you can use as well on top of that, should you want to go somewhere else. But we tend to find people really like that approach.
Yeah. Another thing I've seen too with some organizations who do MDR is limits in what they can pull in for log sources. You know, I've had customers go talk to MDR companies and they're like, you know what, we can't ingest Palo. You know what, we can't ingest, you know, your flavor of the month EDR, right? So it's like you got to do your diligence up front to make sure that they can actually consume the log sources that you have internally as well. Otherwise, you're stuck.
And the ones you don't have yet.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. That's, I think, the bigger challenge.
Yeah, future proof.
You don't want to be limited.
Exactly. I think that's what we're seeing now too, especially with everything that's happened in the last 6 months, is that all of a sudden digital transformations, you know, moved up to 200 miles an hour. It was already going fast enough. But now it's like, oh, I really need to move to the cloud faster. I'm already running apps up there. How do I monitor all this stuff?
Right.
And yeah, if you don't have a product set that can adjust that, then you're kind of stuck. You got to spend more money. But on the other side of that, one of the things that I think is really cool about what DeepWatch has done with our products, we're not just a service. We also have a suite of products that we've launched as part of this. And Lens is one of the products that we launched as part of this, is looking at the maturity of SecOps for customers and saying, look, yeah, you have all these data sources. Which data sources mean the most to you to be able to feed into the SIM and other product sets? What do we need from them? How can you best use them? And if you're not ingesting something today, or you want to, and you know, let's say we want to start ingesting EDR data tomorrow, what does that actually gain you as far as maturity in your SecOps program and what you can do with it?
Yeah, one of the questions that came in Discord, right? When you think about the MSSPs, there's a magic quadrant. So you can evaluate the vendors across the analyst reviews, right? And you used to do this over at Gartner, I think, as well, Ryan. Are there similar evaluation criteria for the MDR market now? Or is it still kind of hit or miss on how do you evaluate the different MDR solutions that are out there?
Yeah, it's interesting because I don't think there ever will be a magic quadrant. Maybe a couple of years down the road for MDR. And I think actually just recently they went and downgraded the MSSP to a market guide. So the market guides are just including, hey, here's kind of a some people that are in the space. You can go look at them. Here's our recommendation on how to use them. But yeah, that's the number one challenge for customers right now, is not really understanding the difference between the two and then what the outcomes are, right? So when they go out and submit an RFP for, you know, what kind of service they want, they haven't really written the questions in a way that allow them to say, like, I want A plus B equals C, and they kind of write it in some sort of different algebra, but it's not as clear as, look, I just want you to do A and B and C, and instead they give us a paper that says all those other things built into it. So yeah, like really like defining the outcomes and defining what you want from a service is the number one key to being able to use a managed text response service or an MSSP or some kind of combination of both. And I do agree the consolidating vendors down to one makes a lot more sense, because when you do have an issue, you got to be able to have some place where you can communicate that back to them as a, you know, this is the problem, this is what I want you to go fix it. And either the vendor can actually address it or they can't. And then you're kind of stuck in the middle between those two.
So let's double click into the evaluation for a second, because I think you brought up a really good point that you can, I think, guide the audience a bit. What are the types of use cases you should look at as part of an MDR offering? I mean, where do you start? Because if you, maybe you go to an MSSP, but maybe you don't need the full-blown MSSP right now. You just want certain use cases, but maybe you want to expand broader later. How do you evaluate the different use cases, the different offerings that are out there? Where should people start?
Yeah, so I think the first thing that everyone should understand about getting into this business is that you can outsource capabilities, but you cannot outsource risk, right? You can't outsource responsibility. So at the end of the day, whatever you're buying, you're still going to own the outcome of it. You know, so if they miss an alert and you still get attacked and you're still, you know, threatened with having to pay a ransom on something, that's still on you, even though you paid for a service. So the most important things is looking at kind of twofold. But one, can they help you understand your attack surface, right? So like for us, I think a lot of times I'll go to customers and tell them, look, we can start, if you have nothing today, we can start with like vulnerability management and firewall. As in like, let's understand what your network actually looks like and where your risks actually lie, right? Because if we understand that, I can help you build more things into that. And a lot of customers may already have that today. So the other side of it would be, how do we better detect threats for you and better respond to threats for you? So some people need all of that. Some people just need a subset of it. So it's kind of just picking and choosing the ones that make the most sense for where you lack capability internally. And I think a big part of that when we start talking about response for customers is, I think there's a misnomer that, you know, buying the MDR is instant response for customers. And well, in one sense, it's basic instant response. Like we can take an action to help you stop something, but those other components that go into that, to doing the investigation and forensics and everything else, that's a whole separate piece of that. So really piecing apart the things you would need as part of a full-blown security operations program, understanding what you actually can outsource and what you can't, will help customers kind of move down that path in a way that makes more sense and they can consume it more easily.
Yeah, and that's an interesting point, Ryan, because in many cases, if you have to kick into your incident response program and it's something that is affecting the business, many times you're going to go to your cyber insurance, right? You're going to hit your cyber insurance. And at the end of the day, you just can't bring in your own incident response company. It's like auto insurance. You have to go by the carrier's list of approved vendors, right? That's a place you probably don't want to teeter into, right? Because you don't want to overstep your bounds as an MDR company. You want to guide the customer, right? And have that level of thought leadership for them and say, hey, listen, now it's time to engage your cyber insurance so you can get an incident response company in here.
Right, exactly. And I think it's thinking beyond that too, because I mean, even when you buy it, you know this, if you buy insurance for anything, you know, like if they're going to do an investigation and see how it happened, and if it's not clearly in the lines they delineated for what we're going to pay for and what we aren't, you know, I think this is like kind of famous. A lot of people or vendors out there will say, hey, we have $1 million breach insurance for this, use our product and it's there. Well, if you're in the fine print, like you have to have a certain number of products, you have to use a certain service from them, has to be within a certain, like they have had the thing that the first where they breach occurred, sorry, had to have been under their control and they are monitoring it. Like it has to be clearly that they're at fault before that money kicks in. So I think falling back on that, yes, cyber insurance is a good thing to have as part of this, but you have a lot more responsibilities in front of that before those things really kick in or you can even use them if they can even cover the thing that happened for you.
No, agreed. And for me, I mean, like a company like yours, I think a lot of the success of the outcome of your service is based on the model of how you're supporting your clients. And I looked at your website and, you know, you have a lot of great differentiators, right, from your traditional MDR companies. And I look at it and you have something called the squad model. And I thought that was absolutely awesome because the success is going to be your security analysts and your team understanding the customer, understanding their environment, understanding their culture, understanding their people, right? And you know, that makeup is really cool. You have a squad leader, kind of like that level, you know, that service level manager kind of heading up the team. You have a customer success manager, you know, guiding that team, making sure that they have that relationship with the customer so they can better understand the people and the culture and things of that nature. But then a threat hunter, you have support services on that. And then you have, I mean, 5 shifts worth of security analysts. For the clients. I thought that was amazing. It's like a pod.
Yeah,
right? You have a pod of professionals who understand your company.
If the leaders of those respective teams can largely stay the same across your client base, I think you, even if the engineers swap out, you've still got that consistency, right?
Yep.
The negative feedback I've got about MSSPs and the reasons why people have left one provider to go to another are, you know, basically we had an awesome team. And then there was a bunch of turnover, and now we don't have an awesome team anymore. They have no idea.
And nobody understands my company.
So we might as well go somewhere else. Right. It seems like you guys got that problem and saw that problem and are getting ahead of it, which is good.
That's awesome.
100% what it is. And that's actually the first paper I wrote at Gartner back in 2019 was use effective communication to enhance your MSSP experience. Mm. 100% about how you communicate with your MSSP, how you provide them business intelligence, how they use it is going to make or break the difference in how that relationship goes. It's like anything else. Like if you don't communicate with your partner, things are probably going to go wrong. Like it's like anything else in life, right? So us building that model made a lot of sense. And it's scalable way too, because those pods or like the squad, right, that you have in place, there's a lot of distinctive capabilities built into that as well, right? Because one squad might have a lot of healthcare, you know, customers, so that they have a lot of intelligence on what healthcare providers are dealing with and how to address those. One might be financial, one's big, one's small. So the fact that we can kind of build those as we grow, but then the back end kind of use that shared services model for how we maintain the platforms makes this, you know, I think that's, if I've ever heard anything about that, as well, how do you scale? That's how you do it, right? You add in that intelligence where you need it and leave those open communication channels so you can really show the value to the customer. Right?
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. Now you take it to the next level and you understand the industry. Because now you understand their legal, regulatory, compliance needs and all the nuances and kind of niche things you need to do from a control perspective there. Now you're ahead of the game. Now you're proactive with them. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
But you also create, I think, a really interesting way to onboard talent, right? Because if we think about this, you have to scale. Mm-hmm. You have to go get talent. And the squad creates this great support infrastructure for newbies to come on, learn, grow their skills where they maybe move to a new pod or squad as you spin that up. So what's innovative about that is not only from a customer perspective, but also allowing you to consistently bring engineering and security talent into the organization, because now you've got a place where they can learn from others, which helps them grow.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And what's interesting too is like having run SOX in the past and doing mentoring sessions with, you know, brand new security analysts, you ask them like, what's your vision for the future? What do you want to do? And every security analyst will tell you once they start in an MSSP or in a SOC, they want to be a pen tester. They want to be a threat hunter. They want to go do those things that are like the fancier side, right, of cyber. And us having that in there so they can actually see the path. We're like, hey, you know, I can actually do these A, B, C, and D, and I could be a threat hunter, or I can move to this side and do testing. Like that is really great for retaining the talent that we have and actually getting people to come in and see how that grows over time for themselves, and they can see a real career here as opposed to having to hop from company to company.
Yeah, and as part of your service, that pod, you have a threat hunter that's engaged in that team, right? So yeah, exactly. I mean that gives you a level of mentorship just within the pod itself, which is super cool.
Exactly. And that communication channel is so important too for threat hunting, because I mean threat hunting is all about building a hypothesis and testing a hypothesis, right? So if I think something is occurring, how can I go search for it? And having the tools to be able to do it. So the fact that we have that in place, we have the communication, we understand, you know, especially when customers have subscribed to like vulnerability management for us, where we actually do a full scale, kind of like a risk program for the customer. We actually do remediation outreach and work with infrastructure and security and figure out where they actually, you know, do you patch it? Do you isolate it? Like what is the next step for that? Understanding what their risk posture is helps us build those more advanced threat hunts for, yeah, what is really underlying that we can go find that the tools just aren't going to tell us.
Yeah. When you think about evaluation criteria, I mean, obviously security resources are part of that decision criteria. What are some of the other things, you know, budget has to play into? Do you build it or do you buy it or outsource it, right? What are some of those key criteria for people to really evaluate? Do I want to build this capability or is it better for me just to leverage an existing MDR service?
Yeah, I think starting off, it's good for everyone to realize that maybe like 1% or less of companies in the world can afford to really have their own SOC and staff it the way they need to and really build out everything that's there. So almost everyone's going to be using some sort of hybrid model, which would be in-house capabilities and outsourced services. So the biggest part of that, again, is going back to like evaluating what's the outcome, what could you possibly have in-house. So like, you know, let's say you're a company that's based in Orlando. I mean, there's some good cyber talent in Orlando. You could probably find a couple of good analysts. You could probably find some people to manage tools for you that you can keep in-house. And again, I'm all for if you can grow things in-house and do things your way and own it, it always just feels better, right? So you can do that part. But then, hey, I'm not going to be able to find, like, I don't want these guys doing commodity. I don't want them doing basic, like, OR triage. Let me look at a service that could do that for us so that they can be focused on the real important things that we need day-to-day in the business set. So some of those things as you're looking at evaluation, the flexibility that a service gives you to build around that model, that hybrid model, I think is what is a real key to being able to find the right service provider for you.
That's a huge benefit. I mean, that's something that my organization talks about all the time too, right? You as a company can be in like three modes. You can be in run mode, grow mode, or transform mode. Why not leverage the power of a managed services organization to get your head out of the run and allow the talent that you can have, right, to focus on growth and transformation within your organization? It's a no-brainer, right?
Yeah, it totally makes sense. And what's cool too is, you know, like 3 years ago when I was running the SOC and MSSP, know, things like, I mean, Slack was just coming up. Some of the communication platforms were just coming up. And now it's like all of our customers have their own Slack channel with us. When they need to get a hold of an analyst, they just really go in Slack in their team channel and get a hold of the analyst. Where in the past, calling the line, you know, press the number, dial this to get somebody, that collaboration part has really made a big difference for at least the customer success data I've seen.
Yeah. Yeah. And I took a look at your architecture on the website and, you know, some of the innovative technologies that you have, including like ServiceNow. It looks like you're using ServiceNow on the back end where, I mean, just the ability to do e-bonding within ServiceNow with customers where you can say, listen, I will connect into your ticketing system. Right. And I will be able to hand a ticket back and forth between our two organizations. So that way that collaborative effort is, you know, a lot more streamlined, a lot more quicker to be able to get information in front of customers.
I took e-bonding as meaning something completely different. So I'm glad you explained it.
That's not e-bonding.
It's not Ashley Madison.
We can talk about it on the next segment.
Gotcha.
but Ryan, I think the other important thing is you can't outsource everything. There is still a risk component the organization needs to own, which means there's still a responsibility. Even if you try to outsource as many capabilities as you can, the organization still has to own aspects of the risk and managing the relationship. So it's not like you can outsource 100% either.
Well, and I think that's a great point, Matt. It begs the question. And I want to get Ryan's opinion on this because I've, you know, guided enterprises that are looking at managed service of some kind, right? And I've always kind of like framed it as you got to pick and choose, right? Pick and choose stuff that can be outsourced more easily than other stuff. And that decision is going to depend on what you're really good at in-house, what you want to do in-house and what you don't want to do. And maybe that leads you to what you should outsource. So like, Ryan, how do you guide people as to picking and choosing maybe what's the best things to outsource?
Yeah, I always tell them to look at where are your business decisions, right? You need to own the business decisions in-house. And a great example of that is like user behavior, right? So there's a lot of technologies out there that will do some sort of correlation, causation for, you know, this is a good activity or bad activity, right? Someone in the business still needs to decide if that was good or bad, right? Like they're the ones that either own the computer or they're in that network and said like, well, yeah, like, you know, Susie shouldn't have had access to that. We need to go fix that, right? Someone has to make that decision. So when you're looking at what to outsource and what to keep in-house, you want to keep those business decisions in-house. It might be one person, it might be 10 people, whatever that is, part of the organization, but they have to own that. And that is where the risk lies. And that's where the risk tolerance is built into it because they have to make the determination of, you know what, that's okay for that to happen, or, you know, we can let the provider make that decision. We want them just to block things that are bad for us and tell us that they did it, and they want to run it that way. So every organization has to make that choice consciously and know that's part of the decision-making process.
Hmm. Yeah, lots of decisions to make. Ryan, thank you so much for joining us on Business Security Weekly.
Really appreciate the time, guys.
To learn more about DeepWatch's services or to assess your SecOps maturity for free, please visit securityweekly.com/DeepWatch. We're going to take a quick break and then cover the leadership and communications articles for this week.
DeepWatch provides innovative managed security services that empower organizations to be more resilient against today's evolving cyber threats. DeepWatch offers game-changing capabilities in managed detection and response, managed endpoint detection and response, and vulnerability management, all delivered through a unique squad model, a dedicated group of security experts that works directly with each client. From managed security operations to threat hunting to continuous measurement of security readiness, DeepWatch is advancing the service of managed security. Measure your SecOps maturity for free by visiting securityweekly.com/DeepWatch. Most breaches are caused by exploiting oversights in basic cybersecurity fundamentals, but complex hybrid multi-cloud infrastructures make cybersecurity hygiene challenging. Red Seal can help. It shows you what's on your network, how it's connected, and the associated risk across public cloud, private cloud, and physical environments. With Red Seal, you'll get control of your cybersecurity fundamentals so you can protect your organization from the inevitable attack vectors and reduce your cyber risk. For more information, visit securityweekly.com/Red Seal.
Welcome back to Business Security Weekly. I am your host, Matt Alderman, joined by Paul Asadorian and Jason Albuquerque. Do you have a specific guest or topic that you want us to cover on one of the shows? Submit your suggestions for guests by visiting securityweekly.com/guests and completing the form. We will review those monthly and reach out to you once reviewed. You can also do it through Discord too, because we had the last episode we did came through Discord actually, which was a fun way to get the feedback from our listeners. Also, in our October 22nd technical training, we will provide a first look at a new free resource that delivers thousands of remedies as a service to bridge the gap between vulnerabilities found and vulnerabilities fixed. Visit securityweekly.com/webcast to see what we have coming up, or visit securityweekly.com/on-demand to view all of our previously recorded webcasts. We did a fantastic webcast with Accurix last week on modeling out your cloud infrastructure and applications and looking at the different threat landscapes overlap. If you didn't get a chance to see that demo, I just, anybody who's deploying cloud, deploying applications in containers, just a fantastic segment.
Garner has that on their list, cloud security posture management. We'll talk about it.
Yes. Well, it's kind of what they call it.
That is what they, that's what they call it, yes.
That's what they call it. It's a little more than that, depending it on is. How you define it.
It would fall in that Gartner bucket, but as typical of Gartner, it would do it a disservice, I think, to squarely put it in that round peg in the square hole, basically.
Yeah, because I think a lot of the CSPMs went after the runtime side. What I think is interesting with Accurix is they look at the static configuration files before you spin up the infrastructure.
So cool.
And monitor it in runtime. So you get that marriage between static and dynamic, which I think is really interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, very cool.
Yeah. All right, some great articles this week. The first one, I just thought this was good, right? A lot of people have heard me talk about the role of the CISO and how I think the role is going to transform over time, away from operational, more to governance. Mm-hmm. This article from Forrester talks about the six different CISO types. We had Janan Budge on Business Security Weekly at RSA Conference earlier this year, which is part of where I think some of this article came from. But Jason, I thought it was a good way to break down the different types of CISOs and where they thrive.
Yeah, 100%. And it's a lot of it's personality type, right? I mean, at the end of the day. And
I think size of company, too, dictates a lot of these roles.
Culture of company.
Yeah.
Because you could have a small company, right? Mm-hmm. You could have a culture that they're a smaller company, but the culture doesn't allow you to kind of be that strategic CISO.
Right.
The one thing I do want to point out about this article, at least from my opinion, is you're not pigeonholed into one of these. I feel like you can be a transformational CISO, customer facing at the same time, and hey, maybe be a post-breach CISO, right? Yep. And be effective there. So really, you could be multiple pieces of this puzzle. And I would think the most well-rounded CISO plays a little bit in all of these, right?
Mm. Yeah. And, but I think when the company gets big, a lot of these are separate CISO roles, right? You've got your customer-facing CISO, you've got your product CISO, you've got your IT, you've got your compliance. Those may be like four or five different roles there that could really carry the chief security officer.
And I'm starting to see a trend, though, Paul, of BSOs rolling up to CISOs. And you have that business security officer. So they're focused on a business unit.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Well, because I think we're a lot of us are trending towards more functionally focused teams across the board, not just in development and DevOps, as we've talked about, but I think across the board, quite literally in some cases, right? Where it's focused on a function of the business and it's a cross-functional team.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
Go
ahead.
I was going to say your BSO role reminds me of what I thought would happen in some respects, right? Is that security would have to be embedded in aspects of the business unit themselves, 100%. Right? And it wasn't necessarily going to be a full-blown CISO, but somebody who really understood the business unit and what drove the business models for them, reporting back into, it could have been a CTO role, it could have been a CISO role, it didn't have to be one or the other, but security had to be more aligned to business. Mm-hmm. And so that's an interesting trend, because I think that is critical.
Yeah, it's definitely something I've been starting to see. With organizations hiring into that BSO type role, and they have different job names, right? But that's the nature of the beast, is a business unit level security officer, right? Who kind of aligns to that business unit. They understand the business unit, and then they roll up to a more strategic CXO, whatever it may be. Yeah, I've even seen privacy officer, where some of them are rolling up to privacy.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know? Well, because if privacy is a big part, because you have a lot of consumer data or something like that, privacy may be the bigger driver from a security perspective in that organization.
Right.
In traditionally we've seen more of the tactical operational CISOs coming out of the technical side. I knew that that skill would have to transform over time because I'm also seeing the evolution of CTOs taking on aspects of part of broader architecture projects, right? Or maybe the CISO doesn't own some of that tactical or operational stuff. And then, you know, the one on the bottom, the customer-facing evangelist, I mean, that's always been Qualys' CISO role, right? Sure. Like Ben Carr in that role now. It's always been out to understand the security and be able to evangelize that to their customer base versus more focused on the internal security for Qualys.
And a lot of times you're leveraging security as a differentiator, right? And that's when you're coming out there and being that evangelist where – you know, you're showing your customers that here's what makes us different, right? We're putting security first, right? We have this executive who's going to partner with you and really be that evangelist and get those. A lot of times from my perspective, my conversation with customers is more along the lines of gathering their requirements. Yeah. So I understand how to influence the business on the back end.
I've seen that called like a field CISO.
Yep.
Right.
Yep, absolutely.
Because you're out there with customers like massive collecting that.
Yep.
That's in a very important role.
It is. It is. I mean, unless you have that direct communication, and we talked about it in the segment before, unless you have that communication with your customer, you're not going to fully understand the requirements or the expectations they have of you.
And the more customers you get, which is good because you're growing, right? You may need another role.
The more difficult it becomes
to keep in touch with them.
That's right. 100%.
Exactly. And regardless of the type of CISO you are, what are the five habits of highly effective CISOs? So the second article is, it doesn't really matter the role. I mean, this is really focused on communication at the end of the day and collaboration.
Leadership. Yep.
Yeah.
And I think it's some of, it's not all of, right? You know, some of the things that I pulled aside that weren't in this list were things like, you know, trust and influence, right? You always have to stay true to your North Star, right? Because ultimately you're building those relationships and a lot of the influence you're gaining is because of the respect those other leaders have for you. So don't trade that off, right? Don't ever trade off your North Star. So you're going to come into a situation where you may have to say no to somebody you have a really, really good relationship with, right? Realize that you're in this position because leaders in the organization trust you, right? They trust why you're there. So don't ever take your North Star or your morals, right, and push them aside for the relation, just the relationship piece to keep people happy, to appease people, right? You're there for a reason, right? And they'll respect you more. Other business unit leaders will respect you more if you keep your moral compass.
Yeah, I like to think I've stuck to my guns. When you said that, I kind of did, like, did a mental check. Like, no, because you do build relationships with me. Like, I stick to my guns. Like, and then push comes to shove, I'm like, yeah, no, like, I can't get on board. Like, here's why. Right. But, like, I can't get on board with that, right? And I think that's largely going to be in the conversation we just had on the show, right? Mm-hmm. More so the role of security people, right? Yeah. Is you've done the research. And when you do come across those decision points, security is going to be the one to say, no, this is going to break the build. This is a privacy violation that is way too risky, right? It's going to be those decision points that we've struggled with over time.
Yep.
When you go back 20 plus years, those were hard. It's better to be in a world today where you can have a lot more influence and sometimes control over those decisions.
And one of the other ones I added was be business savvy. Right,
you have to,
and I think those two play on each other, because a lot of times I'll find myself in conversations where I know the answer to their specific question is no,
right?
But the way I bring it back to the table is, all right, let's, instead of talking about the pathway to get there, let's talk about the outcome. Let's talk about the outcome you're trying to achieve, and maybe we're not going to take the exact road that you're looking to go down, but let's see if there's an alternative path to get you to that outcome.
But I also think, Jason, it's important to know what that business unit or team does.
Yes.
Right?
That's being business savvy. because now you can put recommendations out there.
Yes. I like your outcome focus, but I think to get to that point, you have to know what all your business units do. And you may not at first. And if you can have some foresight and know that they're probably going to come to a security crossroads or whatever, or take whatever opportunity you can. I do this at the university all the time, right? Because air quotes, business units, right? It's a university.
Right.
There's all kinds of different departments that are part of a nonprofit business, right? But there's a lot of research. There's a lot of different departments that are supporting all different kinds of activities. Then you've got the whole like operations of 144-acre campus and tens of thousands of people, right? And I'm like, so what are you doing with the control system? Like, what is your daily operations. And understanding that makes you, I think it's a great habit. I don't know if it's on the list, Matt, but I think it's a great habit that you have to develop if you're going to be a really good CISO. You got to understand, like, walk in everyone's shoes.
Yeah, I think it was one of the last ones where it says define organizational risk appetite through collaboration with decision makers. That's part of it.
Yeah.
Right? Where you're learning them. You're like, learning what they're open to, what they're not open to, how their business operates.
Because when they go come ask to do something, you should already have a pretty good understanding of, like, why they're asking for, like, oh, because they're building that product and they're moving really fast because it's this part of the business. That
and to be honest with you, university is a great example of that type, because they're little business units inside of a big business unit, right?
Yeah, exactly. Honestly.
Yes. And I think it's not spelled out here specifically, but those CISOs that are understand the business or business savvy, and effectively collaborate and communicate across, also build a really good culture for security where when you have to say no, people understand, okay, I get it, right? Because it has been a trusted communication, collaboration across the environment. That culture makes it easier, I think, long-term to succeed as a CISO, and it's some of those other elements that allows you to build that trusted culture.
No, agreed. And again, it doesn't always have to be no.
No.
Right? Right. You know, it's what are you trying to get to? Like, what's the end game here? Let's learn about the end game and see if we can help you, right? Because I do. I mean, honestly, I really hate saying no definitively, line in sand, we're not crossed. Sometimes it does have to happen, right? But many times there's a solution. And you can come to it together.
If that business unit is building their systems on Windows XP, your answer is probably going to be
exactly. No. Exactly. 100%.
But that's a lot of the challenges that many of us have faced and still face to this day is, even though you understand what the team does, you understand security, you're trying to help others understand security, but really they just want to push this thing out and it's running
and
on Windows.
And it's funny, you remind me, because a lot of times I talk to my team and I'm like, that one is VBS worthy. And they're like, VBS, verbal bitch slap. Yep. Sometimes it just has to happen.
Yes. And cybersecurity is not a four-letter word because it's made up of a bunch of four-letter acronyms. We talked about a few of them earlier. This was an interesting article because it's funny. They said it's not a four-letter word, and then they rattle off like all these four-letter acronyms.
Right.
You know, you can go SIM, SOAR, CSPM. We can go on and on and on, right?
SASE, the new one.
SASE's a new one.
Yeah, SASE's the new one.
It is SASE.
So you're right. It's not a four-letter word. It's a combination of four-letter acronyms. Come on, get it right.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this article was pretty good. I mean, I took it from more of the non-security focused business units, right? Because we don't talk about security because we don't fully understand it. Well, if you're a security professional, you know, you're trying your damnedest to understand as much as you can. But outside of your business unit, you know, then folks aren't talking about it because maybe they don't understand it. They can't see it, and it's terrifying. Okay, well, I mean, I think it's say easy, do hard. That's why people don't talk about it.
Right.
Honestly. And you know,
because if they don't understand the threat, then there's no risk, right?
Sure. Yeah. Right.
But more and more, I've been getting questions, and I think this has happened more and more just because it's becoming a lot more mainstream. Most people are asking the question. Like, my neighbor asked me yesterday, like, I have my old router. Like, can I just throw that out, or should, like, I reset it to factory defaults? Like, so people are starting to become in tune because of mainstream media, the news cycle, right, of threats out there, right? And the question becomes more so not if there's a threat. They know there is. The question is more, what's the likelihood, right? And what's the impact is more of the question, which is, I think, a very positive thing for cybersecurity.
Totally.
Now, I did advise them. I'm like, just reset to factory defaults, right? Because that's an easy thing to do, and it offers some protection. Because there's things, I mean, inside of routers and NVRAM, and say if you were to get them pulled apart, you might be able to do that. And there's password reuse and all that stuff. So, yeah, by all means, do that, right? Do you have to melt it in the fire pit in your backyard? Probably not. Probably not a good thing to breathe in either.
Yeah, right.
I mean, could be fun, but
Well, you factory reset it. It's a simple red button on the back. And then you just take a sledgehammer to it and smash it. You're good.
Yeah, see, I was going to say, put it about 50 yards out and put some lead through it.
You could do that, too. Yeah, I mean,
you could do that, too.
You got to make sure, and I didn't get into this with him, but you got to make sure you hit the flash chip. Like, you really have to find the flash chip, because you can put bullet holes all around that flash chip, and I'm going to go there with a desoldering wick, and I'm going to rip that flash chip off, and you can. But again, someone with a lot of skill.
Incendiary rounds. Right? Incendiary rounds.
And a lot of motivation. That's the thing. Like, is a nation state country it. After
right.
maybe what's on your router? I mean, maybe, but most likely not, right?
Right? Yeah, Jason, most of the ranges have the little clips to hold paper targets. 100%. I'm not sure it will hold an actual router.
Double-sided so duct tape, like, baby. It'll hold it
maybe
on
there. Something.
There you go.
Put it on a steel target.
Seven strategies for better group decision-making. I thought this was good because Paul and I are in this interesting transition period right now. After the acquisition of Cyber Risk Alliance and the number of meetings that have popped up on our calendars.
Sure. Right? It's a lot. Yeah.
It is a lot, right? Because we're making decisions
more than
about,
we had.
More than you used to.
But it also seems like a lot because don't forget our days are prep calls with guests and shows as well. So we already have, I mean, they're meetings, but not like the meetings we're talking about where you have to have like group decisions, right? They're very specific.
Right. Yeah, they're very specific. We're talking about, you know, integration of the financials and and how we're going to do quoting and all that stuff through a new system. We're talking about labs and the whole startup of that stuff, right? And so I thought this was a very appropriate article. I'm like, I like some of the suggestions in here.
Oh, you
know,
totally.
Keep the team, you know, keep the team small.
Absolutely. Right? Decision probably, by committee sucks. Decision by committee sucks.
But we've had, I mean, to talk about our journey, right? And what's a positive thing is we've had a lot of great conversations about, like, what's the next meeting and who needs to be there?
Yeah.
Like, does this person really need to be there? Mm-hmm. You know, are they optional or are we just going to keep it small? And I think to this point, we've done a good job of keeping it small and focused.
Yeah.
And the team understands that, you know, at CRA very well, you can tell.
And I mean, it depends on what type of meeting you're having too, right? I mean, if you're having a strategy session, you want the strategic folks in the room who are going to make the big decisions, right? And then from there, you kind of, you know, push the meetings downstream to the execution folks or whatever the case may be. And yeah, I mean, keep that team small so you can make those strategic decisions, but also be open to the feedback coming back upstream. Mm-hmm. Because those folks executing may say, it doesn't really work that way.
Right. No, exactly right. And whenever Paul and I are in a meeting, we are instantly the strategic dissenters. So we've got that one covered.
Nice. So you play the devil's advocate that they were talking about in here?
Sometimes.
All the time. I mean, we do. I think we have to, right? I mean, it's interesting with both of our backgrounds coming in. We both have opinions on what works and what doesn't work, right? And as long as you're open and honest about those, you almost kind of play a dissenter role just naturally in some respect.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. Challenge the process.
Which we do.
Which is good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like the one that says don't over rely on experts, right? Because expert opinion is a great thing, but those experts represent a certain domain. It doesn't necessarily mean that they have the context of the environment that this decision is being made in. So that may play as well. Take those opinions, right? Take them, but put them in the context of the decision you're trying to make, right? Or the program you're trying to build or whatever the case may be.
I mean, yeah, from security, like, we know that things are labeled as bad, right? Like, you know, we know TikTok could be a really bad application if you're running an older version of, you know, Tomcat or anything from Adobe. Like, instantly, like, the experts are going to go, based on our experience, that's bad. Yeah. But again, you've got to understand the context. You've got to understand the threat, likelihood, impact, and do the risk equation, which I think is makes your point valid, Jason, in that you need the other, like, why are we trying to use this? To your earlier point, what's the outcome? You know, those type of things have to factor into it.
Yeah.
Although, if it's Adobe, probably still a no.
It might be end of life soon anyways or something.
Yeah, Flash is going away for sure. But.
Yeah, it is. But this is a really good article for people that have to do these kind of group decision meetings. I think it gives you some really good guidelines.
Totally. It's good.
I think this article is way better than Gartner's next article on the top 10 key security projects for the rest of the year.
I didn't see Sassy in here.
I wasn't overly impressed with this list.
No, didn't they create that term?
They did. That's why I was wondering why. I looked at it, I'm like, wait a minute. Literally the terminology that they just created, and they're pushing so much behind, they didn't even include it in their list.
They didn't include it in their list. And some of these I look at, and I'm like, really? Yeah. We're back to risk-based vulnerability management?
Right.
Really? Mm. That's where we're going to focus right now?
It says CARTA-inspired. What is that acronym? I didn't look it up.
CARTA is their continuous process that Neil McDonald rolled out a few years back. I can't remember the full extent of the acronym, but it's like continuous assurance, anyways.
Simplify cloud access controls, whatever that means.
CSPM's in here, big. Paul. Cloud right. Security posture management showed up on the list.
I mean, is SASE, like if CSPM and CASB had a love child, would it be SASE?
You got to throw SD-WAN in there, though.
You got to throw SD-WAN in there, you're right.
SD-WAN has to be part of it.
Yeah. Yes.
It would have to be. But I mean, there are a couple on this list that I think make sense, but... Okay, remote workers, we get it. Yeah. DMARC, we should do it because of phishing email attacks. Totally get it, right? But then you've got some cloud stuff in here. We're seeing application. There's passwordless authentication. Are you kidding me? We haven't even gotten the base identity and access stuff down pat yet. And you're going to push us all the way to passwordless authentication.
But then they go into the hot tub time machine and say data classification and protection. Like, shoulda, woulda, coulda been doing that.
Yeah, that should have been like 15 years ago.
That's what I'm saying.
So this list, I'm just looking at it and I'm like, I got to rip this thing apart because I'm like, really? This is where we're going to spend our time? In the current environment, I'm just not sure some of these make a lot of sense. Maybe they're easy, but still, I'm not sure these are the priorities organization. Right. So people, when you read this article, take it with a grain of salt.
Right.
I think there are some better aspects to focus on. I think you have to secure your remote workforce. I think you have to look at identity and privilege and make sure you're locking these accounts down. I think multi-factor authentication needs to be top of the list for all of your services. I think addressing your email and DMARCs from a security phishing perspective are key. Some of these other ones, I'm not there.
I think identity and access management needs to be like a whole, at this level, a whole segment and or article that we do better than what Gartner's trying to recommend. Yeah.
I agree.
Right?
I agree.
Because a lot of it's hinting towards aspects of identity and access management, right? Because you still need privileged access. You need multi-factor authentication. You should be doing something to reduce the password use and strengthen the weaknesses. Yep. Maybe it's passwordless, but that's going to depend on a lot of other factors as well and the application of all those, right? I mean, there's many, many different aspects to identity and access management. Mm-hmm. You need to look at what you're doing and see what you're missing and prioritize that as a global, higher-level project, right? Not just go... Well, we'll be more secure if we do passwordless because that may not be true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And one that's not on this list, which leads me to my next article, is the whole supply chain side and the third-party management. And as people are spinning up new services, adopting new stuff, who's looking at those? Not anywhere on this top 10 list from Gartner. The second article talks about, look, these are some of the challenges security folks need to think about when they go to sign up for that next SaaS contract.
Yeah.
What controls can you review? What, you know, what's the fourth, fifth, sixth party risk profile look like? I mean, that's not anywhere on Gartner's list.
Which, by the way, is so important these days, right? I read this article and I said, you know, this is a testament to how security needs to do a better job of finding a way to get baked into the process. They have to get baked into the process in the beginning of the process, right? Whether it be onboarding new partners, onboarding new vendors, new contractors, manufacturers, looking at client MSAs, vendor MSAs, T's and C's. There's so much legal language that gets put out there to organizations when they're partnering with whomever or buying from whomever. But if you're looking at it, there's so much security, compliance, privacy language, limited liability language, right? I mean, you're sitting there, you're reading some of this, and I I have the luxury of having to, you know, partner with my legal team and read a lot of these documents, right? And I mean, sometimes you go cross-eyed and you have to bring in the attorneys to say, what the hell does this mean? Mm-hmm. I mean, there are organizations basically saying, listen, there's zero liability. Even if I am the threat vector for you to get breached, sorry, can't do anything, right? You have to read that stuff. You have to. I mean, even down to breach notification. They're putting breach notification language in these MSAs where they, you know, you may not be in compliance with your own breach notification policies.
So, in other words, if I go to a provider like Amazon, Amazon could say, well, if we get breached, we don't have to tell you.
Yeah.
And then basically, your regulations or laws say if there's a breach, I have to tell my clients.
Not always necessarily we don't have to tell you. Well, there's language in some of those that say we'll tell you by our timeline, which may violate your breach notification.
The timeline.
Right? Yeah. Or breaches, they may say, if it happens, we have zero liability whatsoever. We'll tell you, but guess what? You can't sue us.
Yeah.
you can't reap the benefits of a lawsuit or anything like that, right?
Right. And I think the challenge here is that the business units are making some of these decisions on which SaaS vendors are looking at. And if security's not business savvy, back to conversation earlier.
Right. They're going to go with the cheapest one.
Exactly. and security is going to be handed this contract and say, well, how do we secure it now? Well, too late, guys. This thing's already off and running. This was the old problem back in the shadow IT days, right?
Yep.
When we were all talking shadow IT and all this stuff's being spun up by the business unit. Look, this hasn't gone away. What we're doing, though, is we are adopting some of these additional services to keep the business running in a very remote world. But is security getting a chance to look at these contracts before they get signed, or are they putting the organization at higher risk?
Yeah. Are you proactive or are you an afterthought? And my whole approach is become proactive, get embedded in the process as early on as you possibly can. And that may be reaching out across the lines to legal, right? To your vendor management team, to your product operations team. Wherever that first contract comes into play, when they start vetting the vendor, get infused there. That's where you want to start getting visibility into those contracts, those T's and C's, those MSAs. And I mean, they have legal addendums, right, that get put in. You may have the higher end MSA that has absolutely nothing to do with security, compliance, privacy, none of it. It's just the legal verbiage. And then there's like addendum C, which is privacy. Addendum D, which is security operations. Addendum E, right? So you have to get that entire document set to take a look at.
Yeah. Sounds like you've done this before, Jason.
I've done it so many times, my friend. But it's that necessary evil because, again, you don't want to be stuck on your heels 5 years from now when something happens and you didn't get that level of visibility and you couldn't articulate to the business that level of risk.
Right.
Right?
Yes.
And then 5 years from now, they're going to say, hey, why didn't you tell us about this? And you're going to say, because I never read it.
Not a good answer.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Back to those different CISO types. That's one you don't want to be in.
Nope.
You're the potential breach CISO that just got replaced.
That's right. And honestly, those good relationships with legal, procurement, right? Your product operations team, vendor management, having those good relationships, you don't even know how many times I'll get things punted over to my team because we weren't in that communication string. Hey, wait a minute. Has Jason's team looked at this yet? Right? Which is great. It's a great position to be in, but you have to work at getting that level of relationship to get there.
Yeah. Yeah. You got to build the communication, collaboration, the trust, the culture to be able to see those contracts when somebody doesn't involve you.
100%.
Yeah, very true. Yeah. Gentlemen, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for joining me today. Thank you everyone for watching and listening, and we'll see you next week on Business Security Weekly.